So I'm doing this session because I wish I had this session. I'm doing this for me in 2006. Because there aren't a lot of sessions that talk about how to get through some of the intricacies of what might go wrong and kind of why you would do the things you would do. It's kind of obvious to say, turn on the firewall, but you don't necessarily know why you would do certain things that you need to do. So that's what this session is about. It's about getting it on, getting it enabled, and making sure you don't lose your job. Because the Windows firewall has a little bit of a reputation, and it's kind of a deserved one. Because in the old days, you used to have to stab yourself in the eye, sacrifice a chicken, and dance backwards if you wanted it to work. But that's kind of changed, and it's good, because a breach is inevitable now. And that's not just a pitch for my session tomorrow at 10:30 a.m. But what we want is we want to make sure that you don't have to suffer through that and that you do understand some of the new management capabilities that are there, or just what the heck does that tab that I'm looking at do? Because you've probably at least looked at the Windows firewall. You have to enable to turn it off. But we need to be able to understand that someone is getting in, and we need to know how and why we can stop them from doing what they do. Because this is what a typical attack looks like. An attacker is going to target your workstations with malware. And a lot of times that malware is something that says, click here to enable macros. Malware. So someone's going to run something, and they're going to get on a box. A user will be compromised, and they'll either do one of two things. They'll elevate their permissions on that box so that they can harvest credentials, or they'll start to do reconnaissance. Reconnaissance can be done largely as an authenticated user. So they can learn a whole lot about your environment right there with just an administrative assistant having opened an attachment. They're going to start to move about the network, figure out who's important, what's important. They might scan for different SPNs in your environment to know what services live where. And then they start to do whatever they need to do to get to the point where they own your domain or own the system that they're after. But like all good sci-fi stories, I'd like to prevent an alternative ending. The alternate ending is that you had the host firewalls on. He couldn't do that recon, and he has to try harder. He can't just come in on any old workstation and automatically figure out all the keys to the kingdom. That's what that's about. Because your goal is not to stop the attackers, it's to irritate them. Because if you are sufficiently interesting, you're an aerospace company, a medical company, a university, or perhaps a very large software company, someone is going to try really, really, really hard to get into your network. And someone is going to click on something. Your goal is to slow them down, make sure they can't do that recon from the first machine, and make sure they hit a lot of walls. Because every wall they hit is going to be something that you might be able to get noise out of. But attackers do learn how to do new tricks, and they do learn how to do interesting things that might make less noise. And there's things that are always going to be developed, because any security control is nothing but a Turing test if your adversary is a human. They're going to learn a way around it. And if any of you have a boss, they might have asked you last year, how do I disable PowerShell and WMI? Which is the wrong question. And they're asking the wrong question because a very smart guy named Matt Graber did this presentation, which is how to abuse Windows to create a fileless persistent backdoor. So everybody said, oh my gosh, WMI is evil. We need to disable WMI. The real question is, why could I reach this machine on your network remotely in order to do these things? The same thing applies to PowerShell. In the words of Jared, who invented PS Attack, PowerShell is not special. If I can reach a system's ports that are open and there's an interface I can use, attackers are going to use it. So when your boss asks you, how do I disable PowerShell and WMI, the real question is, why can everyone reach a default-enabled command prompt, essentially, whether that be WMI or anything else that's out there? Because let's talk about that authenticated users thing. Anyone in a domain, any authenticated user, can right-click, connect to a computer, and sees who's in the local administrators group. That's true. Because those ports and capabilities are open. And some guys that did a presentation at Black Hat took advantage of that and created a tool called Bloodhound. And they can do derivative admin lookups of everywhere in a domain. Now, real bad guys were doing this long before. But that's where you get that first endpoint, and you get in and look at the different areas that you might want over default ports that are open. RPC, file sharing, querying computers, with the rights of just an authenticated user. That's scary, because I'm certain that you have someone in your environment who clicks on absolutely everything. Yes. So if that person who can click on absolutely everything can see that much about your environment, and if they have the rights to click on something, and 63% of malware infections involve somebody interacting with something, the user is your DMZ. We no longer have a perimeter concept that is the outside world. The user is the DMZ. So if you've ever had a difficult conversation with your boss about, I would like to turn on host firewalls and have network segmentation, think about if they would have ever told you no about having a perimeter firewall. No, that's absolute madness. I bet even your CEO knows to have a perimeter firewall. So if the user is the perimeter, and every single machine on the network is suspect, we have to create the DMZ around them. And that's what we mean by the network segmentation and why we need those host firewalls. So now that I've sold you, you're all sold, we're gonna do some network stuff 101. Because network stuff is the basis of how everything works. That's why we can blame the network guy for everything. Because we need to be able to understand a few networking concepts to understand the next few slides. There's also a joke in here. So TCP, that's a type of protocol, transmission control protocol. This is a reliable way to send packets that go in order and are guaranteed to be in order. HTTPS, things like that are gonna use TCP. That's one protocol. UDP. UDP is good for jokes, because I could tell you a joke about UDP and you might not get it, and I wouldn't care. Thank you, people laughed. Woo-hoo. That's the joke, because UDP will send its packets in a stream and not care if you ever get them. It'll just keep sending them. That's why it's good for streaming media, things like that. ICMP, you're probably thinking ping. I'm thinking data exfiltration and command and control. Because ICMP is a protocol that largely is used to do things like plain text and ping. You can use it to send a ping, which is the alphabet twice, usually. That could also be your entire HR database if you want to get it out of a network. So you might want to rethink ICMP being allowed from everywhere. Now, you do need it for IPv6 negotiations, so nobody get me on that one. But attackers love default ports. If I know that there are going to be the ability to get to 445 or file sharing or RPC on every single Windows machine, I'm going to learn how to use that because I know it's there. So they want to be able to take advantage of default things that are on out of the box for you because attackers are lazy. I mean, really, you don't want to do any more work than you have to do. So what can I get by what's automatically there? They want what is already available to them. So a stateful firewall is a very important concept to understand here, because a stateful firewall is what allows you to be able to have a working network while your firewall is in what's called a default deny. So stateful means if I send a packet out, that communication channel is open, the highway is clear, you can come back in on it. That's what that means. So even though you might be listening on a certain port, you don't even have to know the other guy exists per se if you initiate the communication. And stateful firewalls are not terribly well understood, even amongst Microsoft engineers, it turns out, and it makes it a lot easier to configure things, because we don't have to poke a hole for every single possible port. That's how you get the Swiss cheese firewall. So a good example of that, this is Bob's computer, and Bob has his firewall on in a block default state. Now the block default's important, because if you just say block, that's a brick. So that's the Microsoft Windows GUI for the firewall. Block default means that if I send a packet as this malicious hacker in a beanie, because that's what they wear, and I want to do psexec, that malicious hacking tool written by Mark Rusinovich. So if I want to do psexec to that machine, I'm going to send packets over essentially RPC and file sharing. But they're unsolicited packets. I did not initiate communication to Bob the hacker, so I didn't ask for it. I'm dropping this packet. That's stage one of the firewall. That's the part most people would understand, the block part. But here I am again, in a block default state again, default deny. But I need to do some very important work. So I'm gonna go look for some awesome cat pictures. And I reach out to Bing. Now I reach out to Bing over HTTPS. So I'm reaching out over TCP 443. What port do I need to have open in my firewall to be able to get my awesome cat pictures? None, because it's a stateful firewall. So since I asked for it, it's going to let that packet in on a very high-value port, those ephemeral ports out in the distance. So since I want my packets being completely dropped if I didn't ask for them, so people can't crawl around my network and look for things, I can be in default deny. So let's find out if you ate your chocolate. Pop quiz. What port does a Windows 7 client have to have open in the firewall to get group policy? Ding, 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 guy in the front. So the answer is none. You could have that firewall say none, because the group policy update process in the background, GP update, would reach out to AD and it would come in. So that's what that would look like. AD, System Center, whatever else where I have a client-initiated communication. I can ask for it and it gives it back. But there are caveats to this, and this is probably where any of you who've tried to enable the firewall have had a problem. Because let's think about remote assistance. That's the actual remote assistance icon, by the way. It's a little weird. So I've got a blue screen, I need remote assistance, something's happening. I need to reach in on 3389. It's not in there, it's in the block default, but because he's initiating communication, I would drop the packet. So you do have to know what's working in your environment, who they are, where they're coming from, and what agents might be, as far as management things go. Because you're probably thinking right now, this might irritate me more than the attacker. But have no fear. Because what we can do is we can go into the Windows Firewall properties, and we can click on logging. And you can do the thing that I want every one of you to go home and do, even if you don't block a single packet. You can log successful and dropped connections. You can get historical Wireshark. Think about that from a troubleshooting perspective, first and foremost, right? Because if I can get this thing, I've got a SQL admin on the phone. He thinks it's you, you think it's him, we both want to blame the network guy, but you see that it's reaching you. The packet has hit you. You've got that historical record that the packet hit you. It's not your fault anymore, right? So that sort of troubleshooting thing, or from the perspective of somebody who would do forensic investigations and incident response. This helps out a lot because we can see what happened a lot better. So even if you never are allowed in your environment to block a single packet, go home, configure that GPO as it showed on the previous screen, the slides will be available for download, and you'll be able to get this historical record. Now this is a text file, so it's not perfect, but there are some logging enhancements available out there that can make it a little bit better. But that's gonna help you figure out what went wrong. I turned on my firewall, everything went like that Jessica girl said, and all of a sudden all my apps aren't working. You can go here and get a definition of what is happening in your environment beforehand, and then also troubleshoot what might be going wrong once you enable it. Because exceptions are okay. It is okay to look that you dropped a packet and then decide you need to open something up, as long as it's a trusted source. We don't want to enable 3389 remote desktop, remote assistance to the entire internal network. That would be bad. But what we can do is we can say, I'm going to look at that, and I'm going to build something for what I know to be the help desk's terminal server or utility server. I'll put in the IP address of that, and now when they send it in, it fits the rules that are allowed, and it'll allow the packet in. Perfectly okay. Now, you might be wondering, where do firewall rules come from? There's some basics to the firewall that we need to understand. You can get to the local configuration through wf.msc. That's the firewall console. Now, there's firewall console and there's firewall console with advanced security. I don't know why there are two, because you only want the one with advanced security. So, you bring that console up, and that's how you can configure things locally. There's a service, it's MPSSVC, that's the Windows Firewall service. That's probably what you right-clicked on and disabled. Don't disable the service. So there are multiple reasons to not disable the service that have a lot more to do than the depth of the tinfoil hat I wear. If you disable that service, you are not in a supported state and you have downstream ramifications for things like Windows Remote Management and Windows Event Forwarding. If you disable those services, those things don't work. And you may never know that until you need them. So disable the firewall if you need to through a group policy or something like that. Turn it off so it's not blocking anything. Your AV product may be doing this for you. But if you have that service disabled, a lot of other stuff isn't going to work for you and it will be very mysterious and difficult to troubleshoot. There's group policies for this, like with all things. They're under Windows Firewall with advanced security. And The cool thing about this is you can configure everything you might want to do in the firewall all within the same policies, all within the same interface. I don't have to go somewhere to turn it on and then somewhere else to make a rule and then go make an IPsec rule somewhere else. I can do it all in the exact same policy. And like all good things, there's a command line. We've got PowerShell, we've got NetSH ADV firewall. I don't have enough time to go through all of them, but they're there for you too, so you can do all that neat PowerShell stuff. So built-in rules. If you've ever built a new computer, you're going to notice if you bring up wf.msc that there are rules present for you already. These aren't optimal. Because as you build your Windows computer fresh, you're going to notice that you're listening on things like RPC, file sharing, things like that to a lot of places. So you want to be cognizant of the built-in rules that are there. Because a lot of them may not be what you want in your organization, and as long as they're there, there's a possibility that they might reemerge like zombies and bite you. There's also locally built rules. So you can bring up the console, you can build a rule in there, and that'll exist as well. These things all coexist, it's a little weird. And then there's group policy rules. So you can go in and you can create rules and group policy, distribute them through all your computers. That's the one I want you to do. I want you to centrally manage these things. Now, weird thing, you might notice that I have one of my rules labeled with CO for Contoso. The reason that's labeled for that is if it wasn't there, you would have no idea that was a group policy rule because it doesn't show you that in that GUI, and it's really confusing as to which ones are local and not. So, pro tip, label them like that. It'll save you a lot of hassle once you have 1,500 of them. So the processing order for this, how does it decide which packets to let in? So first off, Windows service hardening gets processed. Now this is something not a lot of people know about, I don't think. Some of the services in Windows have already defined essentially firewall rules that they can only communicate on certain ports, protocols, or to certain places. So when that service starts up, it's got its own little built-in mental IP tables of sorts. And those always get processed first. Next come connection security rules, which are like old school IPsec. So IPsec being IP security, don't leave. Okay. IP security, if you ever had to manage it in the old days, really, really insane. A lot of it done with connection security rules more than anything else. Authenticated bypass rules also come from security or IPsec. Because what that is that allows you to essentially block everything, but as long as it's authenticated, it can tunnel through whatever's blocked there. And then block rules. So I have a block. All things are denied for port 445 on this system. That's get processed before the allow, obviously. Then we do allow, including allow if secure, which says you can send me this packet if I know it's encrypted or encapsulated or done something with IPsec. And then default, whatever the Windows properties show, whether that be allow, block, whatever else like that. Or that's how it's supposed to work. So you will notice some things that get weird when it does it, but it's important to know how these things process so you can know how to build them. And then there's a big caveat. Remember that thing I said about local firewall rules? So if you have your console up and you see all those rules, there's a guy with his laptop in the back, so I know that's what he's doing. If you look at all those rules, it doesn't tell you whether or not one's enabled or if it processed or if it was created locally or not right away. Because you could create the world's best group policy firewall. All things are disabled. And then someone could come along who has local admin on that box and put in allow, allow. And that would, if it didn't overlap with anything, it would process that. So a really important thing I want people to know about the Windows firewall is something called rule merging. Rule merging is how those rules work together to say, I'll take the local one as well as the group policy. I like rule merging to be turned off because that means that you are in control of that firewall. You are the authoritative source for the rules. You might want to leave it on while you're kind of like getting used to things or, you know, troubleshooting or whatever, but you really want that to be something where the authoritative source is the group policy and rule merging is turned off. If any of you have worked with this before and didn't turn rule merging off, you might have light bulbs going off in your head because that's what will happen. And there's another thing, and I am not calling out Firefox here, lots of apps can do this, but as you install an application, it can create its own rules. So you could have the world's most perfect firewall, and then an app could get installed, and it could create its own rules. And they would be allowed if you had rule merging turned on. And a lot of those rules are a little bit less than optimal. They're going to say that that executable can do anything it wants to any port it wants. That's what most of them say. And that's probably not the rule you would want. So rule merging is a kind of an important thing to keep in mind, because you want to be able to get to the point where you are authoritative. Otherwise, you're not really in control in building your own little user-based DMZs. So firewall profiles, how many of you have taken your laptop home and it suddenly shows you a park bench? The park bench is not just an adorable little place to sit. This is actually a representation of something that's been in the firewall since the beginning. The concept that as I move from location to location, I might need different firewall rules. Because that's actually really cool. Think about it. You have some sort of unsecure application that's mission critical, uses Telnet. It's absolutely terrible that it would use Telnet, but you need to have it. You might want to say, if you are on the corporate network, that port is allowed to listen. But if you go to Starbucks, not so cool, right? And that's that concept that you can use the profiles for. But if you don't define the profiles, they're going to get that pop-up. So this is something to keep in mind. You've got domain, public, and private. And you can be in control of all of those except domain. Domain is based on whether or not you actually talk to the Active Directory domain controller. For Windows, we know you did that. And that's actually quite good, because that'll tell you whether or not you're on network. Not all of these were exposed in the old UI. If you had 2003 and you set up a bunch of firewall rules and your server got vMotioned to another ESX host, and then you got fired, that's why. Because this probably was the cause of a lot of suffering and loss of jobs, because the only thing that got exposed in the GUI was the domain profile. So you could have something very important, a payroll server of some kind, put in the right ports, something happened, it blipped on the network, it thought it was somewhere else, port's not open, service down, you get a new job. So you can always have managed those, by the way, with the command line, not that any of you are still running 2003 because that's not supported. But if you have a server, and your server is never going to go to Starbucks, and you like your job, if you're not planning on using all three of those profiles, you might stick them in there anyway. This seems hard to manage. That's what at least one of you is thinking. It is a little weird to get used to, but it's a group policy, right? I mean, if you think about using an antivirus product or something else as your firewall, that's managed in another utility by another team in another location. They might break your service and you have no idea. How many of you have a group policy? At least one in your environment. 100% of you because you have the default domain policy. So, but you have a experience managing a group policy. So group policy is dead. Microsoft's been saying that for years, but whatever. So we want to be able to use group policy to manage the firewall. Here's a huge usability tip. If you create a whole bunch of rules and you like them, you can cut and paste in the firewall console. Ooh, I learned this from a customer, so I think it's huge. So let's say that you only have to change like one thing, one iteration. Maybe it's a different port, maybe it's a different source address, something like that. Cut and paste them. Build your whole reference thing there. The other thing is that you can build profiles based on the policy. I'm sorry, you can build like a policy that's a standalone template. There's a thing called a WFW file. And you can import these into a group policy, or import them locally, or import them via command line. So you can take a reference machine, something that's your ideal corporate template for the firewall, export that policy, and import it wherever you need to. So you can build a starter one for your default server template. It's got SCCM, remote control allowed, or whatever else you might need in there, and then import it, and then just add the SQL Server port, or just add the IIS port, something like that. So you don't have to reinvent the wheel every time you do this. You do not have to cut and paste 700 rules every time. So the WFW files are huge, because I don't think a lot of people know about them. And that gives you that ability to kind of also scale, you know, maybe an unmanaged machine. Maybe it's not domain joined. Maybe I'm using DSC, or desired state configuration, or maybe I'm using Ansible, Puppet, or Chef. But any of those things, you could make them use the WFW file and import it for you. One of the things that really does help out if you are thinking about security in general, whether or not that be the firewall, is to remember that organizational units are policy boundaries. They're not pretty manila folders. So you want to have a granularity to them that will allow you to create firewall policies related to something in common, whether that be a service or administrators or anything like that. And this will help you out a lot if you're doing lateral movement mitigations, those things from the past, the hash white paper, best practices for securing AD. Because you need to be able to get to an idea where you're defining not just the firewall, but who's a restricted group, who's an admin, things like that. That's too much to do in this session, but you want to think like that. You want to aim for default deny. You want to aim for block default. So that should somebody come up with something new, should somebody come up with, you know, a vulnerability that they can exploit remotely by connecting to a port, you probably got a while before we patch that. It takes a long time to fix Windows. There's a lot of stuff going on in there. So if somebody releases something new and remotely exploitable, and you have to reach it over RPC, And you know that RPC is default denied except for this one server that's really, really locked down and, you know, you have to have somebody point at you with a gun to get to it. That makes you have a little bit more leeway, doesn't it? Right? So that's the idea, is to aim for default deny and plan on the fact that security is really kind of an arms race right now and we're all losing. So you want to be able to think about that. Make sure that nothing that isn't needed isn't open, and the things that are needed are open to only the trusted sources. Because just the basics can slow down a lot of attackers. Right now, about 80% of the IRs that I've worked in the last 2 years, they got in, did a phishing email, somebody enabled macros, and they just tore through the environment. They did recon, they did what they needed to do, they figured out who they needed to hit, they got domain admin if they wanted it, they got the service they needed, they were out, right? We want to slow them down so that we notice that they're there, that they have to work harder. And just the basics of not letting all of your workstations talk to each other on RPC and file sharing can slow them down a lot. Nothing's perfect, but that's what you're aiming for. You are not aiming for great leaps of gold medal Olympic firewall building. Which brings me to IPsec. So IP security, it's a protocol that you can use to secure IP communications. I know, they're not very creative. And a lot of you are probably thinking, IPsec, I would like to get out of here, if you've ever worked with it before. But IPsec does not have to be terrifying. It can be usable. But first, we all have to understand ESP, which is not extrasensory perception, but encapsulating security protocol. If you have ESP, it might help, though. Because encapsulating security protocol is how the Windows firewall implementation of IPsec works. IPsec, a lot of people hear it, and they think encryption. They think VPN. They think something like that. But IPsec is way more than just encryption. Because what we can do is by taking that encapsulating security protocol, we can magically transform a non-conforming app that doesn't do what we need it to through just adding an IPsec policy. So let's take, for instance, a normal packet. That normal packet is reaching out to a file share. And that file share, reaching over TCP 445, is going to be a secret HR file share. Only certain people should be reaching this share. We want to make sure it's locked down. That's what we're thinking here. So if we did it normally, it would just be TCP, it would just be a packet, you'd see it in Wireshark, it would say SIFS or SMB or whatever. But then we have the concept of null encapsulation, which means that we can wrap that packet in ESP. So we take our 445 packet and we add an ESP header to it. So the ESP header, the encapsulating security protocol header, is going to have information about the computer and the user that we're connecting to it. And that'll be authentication information, whether that be Kerberos, certificate-based, or NTLM if you're insane. But we want to make sure who we're talking to, right? So null encapsulation does not encrypt a packet. It just labels it up, says that this is whoever is using that packet from this machine, and then sends it over UDP 500. So that's encapsulating with null encapsulation. You're not encrypting it. People can still decrypt their traffic if they need to. And you've magically made that service more secure because only HR, if you know what you're doing, can actually get to that port now. But we also have an important thing called integrity protection. Now, integrity protection means that if I'm doing a massive financial transfer and somebody edits the data in flight, I want to know about it, right? I want to know that it was tampered with. Or perhaps I'm worried that somebody might just turn off IPsec through some sort of weaponized IP protocol, right? So I want to know that my packet left and came in order and was not tampered with. So that's what integrity protection is. So I take my 445, I put ESP header on it, and then I do the SHA of the packet there. So what I do is I put a hash value, the hash value being a cryptographic function that tells you essentially that this random string is what that packet was. So I put a hash value with it too, so that when the packet leaves and when the packet arrives, I know that it hasn't been tampered with because it's got the matching hash value. So integrity protection, something that you would probably pay a lot of money for, is included for free 99 with IPsec via group policy. But wait, there's more. Because we could also do encryption. So let's say that you have that terrible Telnet application that's sending plain text data, or a file share that's sending plain text data, and you want to make it better because you can't get rid of it because it's important and it's legacy and you need to keep it. So what you could do is you could take that packet, you could stick a header on it so you know who they are and where they're coming from, and then you could encrypt it. AES 256 encryption over Kerberos or certificate or whatever else like that. That's the power of IPsec. And you do not have to be a wizard to be able to use it. I promise. So that's a kind of a hard topic for a lot of people. So take a deep breath, know that you will probably download this slide later, and let's move. Because this is Steve the attacker. So Steve the attacker is trying to use the stolen credentials of Bob the domain admin. Credentials are far more valuable than malware to most attackers, because what they can do is they can use that identity to do whatever they need to do on the network. So he has Bob's domain admin account. That's pretty game over, just so you know. But he's trying to use Bob's domain admin account to use a PowerShell utility to copy off a copy of ntds.dit, the Active Directory database. So he's going to try to do that. But we've built an IPsec rule that says only Bob, the domain admin, and only from the computer that is Bob's privileged admin workstation are allowed to reach in on TCP 5985 or Windows Remote Management. So that would be our ASP header. It would have the encryption or the authentication in it. No encryption even at this point in time, just the authentication. It says it has to be both the PC and the user in question. So he tries to connect from his leaked laptop and he gets denied because he's not doing it right. Identity-based firewall rules. That's kind of a cool concept, isn't it? Because you don't have to think about having ability to not just rely on ACLs or anything else like that. I know this data is sensitive. I know this data is regulated. I know this data is high value to an attacker. I can use groups in Active Directory to make sure only the people that I want can access it. And those people are likely managed by your identity management system. So think about a help desk. A help desk typically has a lot of turnover, right? So you would typically say, okay, everybody in this subnet is probably a help desk machine and they can do everything possible on the network. Now, help desk people are clearly the most educated and longest tenured people in your environment. That might not be a good idea. So if you have a lot of churn there and you've got something like an identity-based group managed by your IDM system that says help desk people that are working here this week, you could say only those people and only those accounts can reach those things. And maybe a group of computers managed by SCCM or something like that. That's pretty darn tootin' powerful right there, because that port doesn't even exist unless you've authenticated to it. So, okay, we doing good? We doing okay? We haven't had our brains explode from the IPsec goodness yet? Okay, because IPsec is involving a lot of getting to know each other, because we do what's called an association, a negotiation of security, a security association. I have to know you're Bob, coming from Bob's computer. We have to do that Kerberos dance, and we have to start to talk IPsec, because that was a packet that was file sharing before. I have to say, parlez-vous français? Why oui? You know, we have to be able to speak the right language. So those security associations, you can track them in the monitoring area of WF.MSC. So the Windows Firewall console, it's not just those rules and whatever. There's an area at the bottom called monitoring. And that monitoring will show you whether or not you've made a security association. So a lot of times people try to do an IPsec or security rule and it just doesn't work and they give up and go home. Look to see if you've got a security association, because you may not have been able to do that for one reason or another. Start a packet capture. If you see bidirectional packets labeled ISACAMP, you are negotiating. If you see them going in one direction, the other side probably didn't get the policy. Because both sides have to be able to know that they are required to do IPsec. Applying it on one side will mean you will have a whole lot of nothing. Both sides have to know what language to speak. The monitoring area of the firewall console, by the way, is very useful because it'll show you which firewall rules are active on your computer at this time. So if you got bit by that I'm in domain versus public versus private, oh no, where's my rule? If you click on firewall there, it'll show you which ones are actively loaded by the Windows Firewall service at the time you're looking. Very good for troubleshooting, because you might have had somebody fall to a different profile. The important thing to know about IPsec is we can verify both the user and the computer before they reach the open port. That's a really powerful set of technology right there, because if I can build something based off those identity-based firewall rules and verify who you are, that your account is active and that you're coming from the right source before you reach my RPC or file share or whatever, that's cool. That is cool and that can help you out a lot. But it's important to know that IPsec is for important things, not everything. You could try to do something where you have a domain that won't let anybody on if they don't have a certificate or a certain thing or whatever else like that. Those are really good ways to get fired. That's domain isolation. You might read a white paper from a company called Microsoft about it. Don't start there. You can get there if you know your network and you know it's reliable. If you have a Kerberos or a DNS issue, or maybe you've got some sort of appliance that stands in the way, or maybe some of your stuff's virtual, or you've got some old network equipment, there's a good chance that IPsec could just stop working at certain points in time. So we want to use it for important things. That's where you want to start, because if you start to use it for everything, you're probably going to want to have more people working for you, and there's going to be a potential for overhead on the machine. So I love IPsec, but I would absolutely not use it on everything. I would figure out what my high-value assets are or what my dangerous applications are, and that's where I would start. Don't get overkill on it at first. So we're going to do what I'm calling a demo. We're going to walk through how to build a role through the GUI, because I think this is very important, because there's a lot of pitfalls that can happen on the screen. And you can get the deck later, don't worry. So we're going to go into group policy, and we've got a Windows firewall group policy already created, so I'm going to go ahead and edit it. And I've already built my reference policy here, so I've already got everything I need in my corporate environment in there. I've already got all my default rules for whatever subset of systems that I'm managing. So I'm going to right-click and do import policy for that WFW file. I get a little warning. See, I told you there were pitfalls you're going to talk through. Because if you import that file, you overwrite everything that's there. Importing a WFW file is an all or nothing scenario. So that's why I say start from one. Don't use it everywhere. Because that's going to build your basic template. So we're going to click yes. We do want to go ahead and overwrite any of the configuration that was already there. I import it. It tells me yes. So good. We've got it imported there. Now these are just little text files essentially, so don't worry about keeping them around, but do label them. Now, if I go to the Windows Firewall properties of wherever that I imported that, I'm going to be able to see something about the state of the system I'm on. You might have seen this before. You can see that the Windows Firewall is on in the domain profile. You can see inbound connections that do not match a rule are blocked, and outbound connections are allowed. Outbound blocking is a very good way to get fired. So be very careful if you think that you want to block all outbound, because remember that thing I said about it comes in on a it comes in on a crazy high ephemeral port? You don't know what those are. So you would have to open up all those ephemeral ports anyway for outbound, which means you've just created Swiss cheese and you may actually break something. So don't think you have to do outbound blocking there. Now when I said don't disable the service if you want to turn off the firewall, this is where you would turn it off. You would either set it to allow, and if you set the firewall to allow, all connections, inbound or outbound, are allowed, guess what still works? pfirewall.log. So you can go without blocking a single packet on your network, allow everything through there, and still get that historical Wireshark of sorts, where you're looking at all the packets going in and out. That's kind of awesome, because that allows you to say to your boss, I want to get into planning mode. I'd like to enable this firewall logging and see what happens. So should, you know, you get a call from a three-letter agency or government agency that says you're popped, you have something you can use for a forensic record of sorts as you're starting to build up what rules might be allowed. So you can be in allow with the firewall on, everything working, service enabled, and still get a lot of the benefits from it. Now, of course, you could just do off, but then if you do off, you don't get the benefits of the logging. But if you're going to turn off the Windows firewall, do it through the Windows firewall properties shown here. Don't necessarily do it through disabling the service, because bad things happen. Okay. So let's say we want to create that role. I've got something important that I need to create a role for. So I'll do new role, and we'll get this little wizard screen here. Now, there are some defaults that you can use, but we're totally awesome people, so we're going to go custom. So if we go custom, you might notice here that I can restrict traffic to a certain program. And if you're a security nerd in the audience, you might be noticing that securing it by a program is done by path. Which means that if I drip malicious program in there and name it browser, it would still work. There's a really cool option that's not presented on this screen, for reasons I don't understand, where you can actually tie this down to MSI code. So if you manage your SCCM environment or package distribution environment, you have the same MSI code through every single upgrade, you could actually tie it down to there. You gotta make the rule first, but you could do it that way. The other thing you can do is you can tie it down to certain services. So if I wanted to make sure, let's say I am running a third-party telnet client on there or something like that, and I want to make sure that the only thing that can connect over the telnet ports from only certain sources is that executable, I could tie it down to a service as well. So So there's a lot of cool things that you can do there. That way, if you had out-of-date application X and it needed to communicate, you could make sure that it was the only thing that could do that. So then we get to pick out what protocol we're using. So whether that be TCP or UDP or whatever, there's a lot of things in that dropdown beyond that. But we want to pick what protocol we want to create this rule for, and then we need to do something that's kind of interesting if you've never dealt with a firewall before. Local port and remote port. Local port, what port am I listening on? Remote port, what port are you coming in from? So if I needed to be able to communicate with Bing to search for awesome cat pictures, what local port would I need to put in here? None. I don't have to have a port in there. Sometimes people say 443, and that's Bing that needs to be listening on that. So let's say that I am doing 5985. Let's say I'm doing Windows Remote Management. I need to be listening on 5985 in order to let somebody remotely manage this. So if I do that, I would put local port as 5985 and remote port as all ports because I really won't know them. Then there's local IP address and remote IP address. Which IP addresses does this apply to? So local IP address probably seems weird. You're like, why would I need to specify more than one IP address? Well, the reason you might need to do that is because if you think about a multi-honed system, or maybe you've got an iSCSI interface, or maybe you're a web server with multiple bindings in it, maybe only one of those IP addresses needs to be able to receive from this range. Think about Exchange, when you had Exchange and you weren't all on Office 365. Or think about, you know, that iSCSI interface. You've got a network card there, a fully working network card. Does it need to talk to anything but that storage device? No, right? So you could pick which local IP address gets what there. And then remote IP address is exactly what it sounds like. Who is allowed to send me that packet, right? So remote IP address would be something like the help desk person's computer. And then we get options. Now, when you're first building these, the option you're going to pick is allow this connection. Because what that'll do is it's going to build a firewall rule. It'll say that 5985 is allowed through. You're going to test that. You're going to let it sit for a while because you like your job. And you're going to make sure that everything works as expected with allow your connection. So we're going to say that only this IP address is allowed to send me 5985, and all the other ones don't work. That's what you want to test. But let's say we wanted to build that identity-based firewall rule. We would hit allow the connection if it's secure. And then magically, through the magic of a GUI, you are managing IPsec. Aww. Because if you ever managed IPsec in the 2003 days, you would be standing on a command prompt right now. Or you would be crying. So what you have is you have these options here, and they may look familiar if you memorized the slide earlier. Allow the connection to use null encapsulation. That says just give me that ESP header, don't do anything else to it. Require the connection to be encrypted. That's your typical IPsec. That's all you need to do to cause Telnet to be encrypted. Allow the connection if it's authenticated and integrity protected. That's where we do the authentication, and then we do that hash value of it. That's how we do it. That's it right there. So we want to do allow the connection to use null encapsulation just to start out here. There's an option at the bottom for override block rules. Let's say that you cannot get to a default deny. You have problems. That you can't get to a default deny firewall. But maybe you know that there's something you really, really, really don't want to allow unfettered across your network. Some sort of protocol. You could put a block in and then create one of these so that the help desk could use it or someone like that could use it. And it will override the block rules. It'll process first there. That's useful if you're like adopting it. So then what we get is now that we have entered the IPsec wizard of sorts, we can now do that identity-based part. Which users are allowed to connect to this port so that when I do that Kerberos authentication, I know who is allowed in. So this is just an Active Directory picker, like any of them that you would ever see. You can pick users or groups of users. So this is where you could pick that help desk group or the HR group or whatever's in your identity management system. Then there's an option for exceptions. And that one's weird because why would I want that, right? Think about it. Let's say you have a group of help desk people, but people that work offshore are not allowed to see certain regulatory data. You could put the help desk group up here and then the offshore help desk group down there. They'll process and say they can't go, but everyone else can. A lot easier on the management. Then the same thing from computers. Because remember, the IPsec is identifying both the user and the computer that are connecting. That's very helpful if we want to make sure they're coming in from the right place. And if you want to get out of the business of managing giant lists of IPs in your firewall rules. Because if you don't want to do that, You can build an IP role that says any of the IP addresses are allowed in, any, and then manage it through the groups. Now that's an advanced step, make sure you can do the balance beam first kind of thing. But that's the idea, is that you wouldn't have to manage a list of IP addresses. You could manage a group of computers. That's appealing. Because that way you could say that all of the help desk computers or all of the privileged admin workstations are allowed to reach this port, but nobody else is. That's where groups of computers become helpful. You can also do the same thing with the exceptions. So let's say that, you know, you issued out privileged admin workstations to everybody except for that guy, he just wanted one, he didn't really need it, so he can't reach it. Everybody wants a paw. And then you pick which profile it goes into. So, you know, decide whether or not you're gonna get creative and you're gonna do different profiles for different places or whatever you're gonna do there. And then give it a name. Again, I like to put the name of the organization abbreviation in the front there because otherwise you're never gonna know which ones came from group policy in the console because it doesn't show it. And then boom, you can see we have made a little lock, which means we have secured things. Everything's secure now. But that is an IP security role in the Windows firewall. Green is allow, red is block, secure is secure. We're very creative with these things. So we made that rule. So we are probably done now, right? We are probably done creating an IPsec role. IPsec needs to be bi-directionally defined, right? So we have to do that in a second. But, oh, this is to show that it doesn't show you which comes from group policy. So necessary and weird step. Since we have to define on both sides that we would like to talk in IPsec, that firewall rule alone is not enough. There are lots of different ways to do this, by the way, before somebody starts telling me I'm wrong. This is just the way I really like for managing in giant corporate environments. Because now we're going to create a connection security rule. So connection security rules, you can use those to entirely do your IPsec if you want to. There's a lot of different options there. But what we're going to do is we're going to use it for that parlez-vous français rule. I would like to speak IPsec with you. So ignore everything at the top and go straight down to the bottom to custom, because those rules will do different things for you, but we don't have time. So custom, endpoint one and endpoint two. This is where you need to be careful, because instead of having any implied directionality like local and remote port, these could honestly be named Bob and Steve. There's nothing implied here. But you need to keep track of it, because endpoint one, you'll later be asked which port it's listening on, and endpoint two, you'll be asked the same question. So if you don't keep note here, you're gonna wind up saying that endpoint two is listening on 5985, nothing will work, and you will be sad. So nothing really too scary here, but just be cautious that there's no directionality at all implied here, like with local and remote port. So make note, endpoint one, endpoint two. So what do we wanna do here? We wanna do an association where we determine that we are doing things in IPsec. So there's a lot of different ways to do that. You can do request authentication for inbound and outbound communications. That says, if you can do IPsec, I would totally dig it. But if you can't, that's cool too. I'll accept you for who you are. But we want to start out with that, right? Because that'll allow us to do that troubleshooting, make sure things that are failing. Because if you're looking in your packet capture and it's ISOCAMP both ways and you're like, I'm a rock star, but then it'll fall back to SMB if it needs to and everybody will be able to do their jobs. That's the idea with that one. But once you start to get things working, there's a require option, right? So I will not allow you to talk to this port at all unless you've done a successful security association with IPsec. That's one there. It's also an option for do not authenticate, but whatever. So, what type of authentication do we want to use here? So by default, in a lot of what I've been talking about today, we would think Kerberos. So that would be user and computer with Kerberos V5. And that means that you have to have a trust relationship of some kind with whatever you're talking to. That's typically an Active Directory trust, you're in the same domain, you've got a trusted domain, or you've got a cross-realm trust with a Heimdall Kerberos or MIT Kerberos realm, and you're trying to do this to Max. That works. Another lesson. So if you're trying to do this with Kerberos, that's the kind of out-of-the-box option, where you can do that authentication and encryption all using the Kerberos protocol. But there is the option to do other things. So you could use NTLM, you could use a pre-shared key, don't use a pre-shared key, or you could use a certificate. So if you have an untrusted domain that you would like to do IPsec to, you could use certificates for that. So there's a lot of different options here. Kerberos is what I talk about in the defaults just to kind of get used to the concept, but there's a lot of different things that you could do if you've got a legacy system out there or something that's just floating out there or, you know, a different operating system. There's different possibilities where you can still encrypt or authenticate or do whatever you need to do to make that potentially insecure application a lot better. So here's where we get to that weird, there's no directionality implied Bob and Steve thing. Because you see it says endpoint 1, and it's got a port. And it says endpoint 2, and it's got a port. So since we don't have a defined directionality, we want to know which one is listening on what. And that's what that's all about. And then we would go ahead and decide what profiles we want it into, just like with everything else. We give it a name. So that is actually how you would go ahead about building an IPsec rule, and you would be able to secure the communications. Remember that you want to toddle before you start to run, though, because we want to be able to get to the point where we are building allow rules and we're getting to default deny. This is a short URL. I own a lot of them, but I particularly like this one. aka.ms/firewall. Currently it points to TechNet. It's about to point to a wiki where we'll have a lot more things that go there. But start to dig in and read, because we only had 16 minutes today. But we wanted to make sure that we talked about what I consider to be the most important misunderstood features of the Windows firewall. That we have to get to default deny, and that we have a lot of capabilities there besides just plain old IP filtering. We have the capability to do an identity-based firewall. We have the capability to create rules in native tools, built-in security versus bolt-on security. If any of you have looked at a product to try to solve an application issue. I have this really old system. I need to pay $6 million to get them to rewrite it so it uses HTTPS and I don't fail an audit. Or a GPO, and maybe you could buy a jet ski like Troy then. But what you want to do is you want to be able to understand when somebody gives you a bad security nugget, you don't tell them no. That's how businesses start to get insecure. As a security person, you have to be able to say, yes, but. And you want to create a lot of different reference architectures that you can keep in your back pocket. IPsec, the Windows Firewall, they help you out with that. Because someone is going to buy a $60 million MRI machine or piece of software that is really dumb. And you're going to have to put up with it on your network. And the attackers are going to love it. And what you can do is you can use some of those built-in versus bolt-on tools and try to get it to be more secure. So this is just a sort of a taste of what you can do, but I want you to understand it. Because you need to start with the basics. Start with the basics and irritate those attackers. Because breach is inevitable, they are getting in, and they're going to do reconnaissance in your network and steal your data. We want to be able to get to a world where the user is the DMZ and the internal network is properly treated as a hostile entity. Thank you.